Good morning, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay. I reside in Chicago, Illinois, and I'll be the host for the presentation this morning. Today is Sunday, March 15th, 2026. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, March 13th. They are the following. For the 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 23,282. That's 23282. And the 10 a.m. meeting on Friday, 23,283. That's 23283. This morning, A Vision for You presents Beyond Human Aid. So our presenter is going to share her personal story of transformation as a result of the 12 steps. You know, I would suggest to you that if we do not gain, you know, some degree of clarity on what our problem is, well, then we're going to continue to go down that rabbit hole of one failed dream, one failed endeavor after another. And I've heard it said that a problem well stated is a problem half solved. So let's be clear on what our problem is. And sometimes what I like to do is to narrow it down to, you know, consider what our problem is not. That helps me, you know, defining a problem by eliminating what it is not is kind of a logical method of evaluation, where if all the possibilities are eliminated except one, well, that remaining option must be the solution. And so for starters, our problem was never food. That was merely a manifestation of the disease, a symptomatic of a deeper issue. And our problem was never how we were raised, nor the challenges we experienced along the way growing up. Again, while these experiences were very real and certainly affects us, no question, they did not cause our compulsive overeating. It wasn't our finances, our job prospects, family relationships, lack of family relationships, or other hardships, all these external things. These were, again, manifestations of a deeper issue. And when I learned for me personally that it wasn't my traumas, and I had many, perhaps you did as well. In fact, I grieve for losing that explanation because that was a ready explanation that just needed solving. And no, that was never the case. And in fact, I would suggest to you that any life circumstance you could identify from your past or your present is not the cause of your compulsive overeating. There's lots of people walking the face of the earth that have issues, traumas, pasts, just as we do, that are not compulsive overeaters. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells us what our problem is. One and only one condition: lack of power. Lack of power. And to the extent that I come to understand and accept that lack of power is my dilemma, that my problem, without reservation, will mark the urgency that I will embrace the solution offered. Now, our text is amazingly clear on what is necessary to access a power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem. It says we must have a spiritual awakening. We must undergo a profound and revolutionary change of heart and mind, an internal shift. And here's the good news. This transformation is available to anyone. It's as organic as a heartbeat, as natural as the breath, you know, one takes. And the big book states in Appendix 2 on this awakening, it says, and I'll quote, it says, "Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic, any compulsive overeater, capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial." So how do we get there? How do we get to this place? I mean, how in the heck does this work? Well, page 59 says, and I may have missed it the first 1,000 times it was read or I read it. It says simply, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Joining us this morning to share her journey in navigating through those very 12 steps and undergoing a spiritual awakening is Renee A. from Oklahoma. And Renee is committed to the 12 steps and the 12 traditions as a way of life. And it's with much gratitude that we welcome Renee to the line this morning. Good morning, Renee.
Hey, Larry. Good morning. Glad to be here. Renee A. recovered in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I'm just very grateful to have a chance to share what God's done in my life. And so let me talk first of all about why I picked the title of this presentation. It's probably one of my favorite phrases in the big book. It's found on page 24 in There Is a Solution. Just to follow up the great intro that Larry did, Bill is talking about on 24, he's talking about the mental obsession and our powerlessness in the face of our disease. And this page is full of dire warnings. It's full of, hopelessness for me as a compulsive overeater. He tells me on this page that the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. He says farther down that we're without defense against the first drink, completely without defense, and that I've had a complete failure in the kind of defense that keeps me from putting my hand on a hot stove. I love the words here. The most powerful desire to stop drinking is of no avail, a complete failure. And finally, he says that when this sort of thinking is fully established in an individual with alcoholic tendencies, or for us, the tendency to overeat or to have, pathological relationships with food, that I have placed myself beyond human aid. I have a disease, and there is no power in this world that can heal me. And I am basically a dead man walking without a relationship with some kind of power bigger than me. And, I love it. It tells me exactly how things are. And, I, from my own experience, can totally and completely back all of this up. In fact, one of the reasons I love the big book so much, it's the thing that made sense to me when nothing else did. It explained my problem and also laid out a solution for me. So the long and the short of it is I'm just a hardcore binge eater. And when I am in my disease, I want to die. My life is just not worth living. This disease did nearly kill me. And so what I want to tell you about is the story about God and what God's done for me. I got to say that really my only contribution to this story was just attempting to kill myself with food and self-will. And as Larry said, the food is the manifestation of a deeper problem. And, again, the big book is very clear about our problem and it's very clear about the solution. So to sum things up, in my childhood, I have been a binge eater ever since I can remember. I don't have any early childhood memories that don't include binge eating. Binge eating at the time did several things for me. It helped me to soothe my anxiety. It helped me to cope with life and with the issues that I encountered. When I was a teenager, I did find drugs and alcohol when I was 14, And that did put my eating disorder on the back burner for a while. But when I was 18, I was arrested for felony possession. And I got to spend 3 days and three nights in the lovely county jail. And I will say that that didn't completely straighten me up. But what it did was it started a process during my teenage years and early adult years of shifting the course more towards food. And away from those other issues. And so when I was 20 years old, finally, I got out from the house and I was able to eat like I wanted to eat and Katie barred the door. I started my compulsive overeating again with a vengeance, and that continued unchecked and unstopped until I got into this program at age 36. So here's the thing, you know, I really don't need to fill in the details for you guys because probably everyone in this room has their own story of what happened to them with the food. suffice it to say that it was, you know, out of control, binge eating, you know, going on a diet, thinking that I had the situation under control. And then, you know, the still worse relapse. And more about alcoholism on page 30, it talks about the general course of my disease. And it assures me that over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. So this is proven to be true in my own life. On page 31, Bill says, in some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. And that, again, is just the story of my journey into this program. I would go on a diet. I would think everything was great because I would have lost the weight. I would buy myself a whole new wardrobe, congratulate myself. And then my brief foray into recovery always ended in a still worse relapse. And so, again, you know, the course of my disease has just been exactly what the big book predicts for those of us that are compulsive overeaters. So let me talk to you a little bit about when I got here at age 36. So that was in early 1995. So I've been in and out of the program for about 30 years. Unfortunately, my story does include relapse. I don't believe that that is God's will for me, but I do know this. Even in a relapse, God can show me things and can teach me. And so, I feel like that's what happened. So when I first got to OA at age 36, and let me just kind of give you what my status was. Physically, I weighed 225 pounds, and I was in a size 24. I was in such poor health that I basically was an invalid. I was completely inactive. I was either in my bed or in my recliner. Funny story, that recliner didn't hold up under the weight, and the frame on that broke several years in because I spent so much time in it. I was, you know, carrying in my groceries was too much for me. I had been in the hospital on the cardiac ward. I was the youngest person in there at the time I was admitted because I was having so many cardiac and blood pressure problems. My blood pressure was so high, I was on a whole bunch of medication. I coated my body in baby powder to keep my rolls from chafing. Summertime was miserable, absolutely miserable. And the other thing is just a combination of my weight and the meds that I was taking. I had to sleep propped up on pillows because I felt like I was going to suffocate if I was laying down. So I couldn't sleep flat in my bed. I have, in my life, have never been so physically miserable. This disease just robs us of all dignity. Spiritually, I would have told you that I was an atheist or at the very least an agnostic, but what I found out later was really, I was just really, really angry at God. And I had prayed numerous times. I didn't grow up with a faith when I was younger, but I did, I'm sure, have some kind of a belief in a higher power, and I just prayed and prayed that God would remove my problem. But, you know, this program helped me to see later what I really was praying for. I wanted the manifestation removed. I wanted my weight removed, but I really wasn't willing to make any kind of changes in my own life. And so, unsurprisingly, things, you know, continued on as they had. And emotionally, really, really angry. I had two children by the time I got into the program. They were 9 and 4, I believe, or 9 and 5. And I was a really, really abusive mom. And I will talk more about that later. But, you know, my kids got yelled at, screamed at, hit. I mean, just I'm a rager when I'm in this disease. I am one angry person. And I used to say that I only had two feelings, numb and angry. You know, God help my kids if they caught me on an angry day. Anxious, I was super anxious. I had an anxiety disorder that was literally ruling my life. I had debilitating panic attacks. I was kind of sort of agoraphobic. I had a really hard time getting out of the house, leaving the house, would never go anywhere or do much of anything because I was just too anxious to live my life and was extremely depressed, suicidal every single day before I found this program. I had a plan to kill myself. I thought it through on a daily basis. And I would say that I probably struggled with suicidal ideation for, you know, like every day for months before I was 12-stepped into the program. So, again, this is what compulsive overeating does to me. This is what living my life on my own self-will does to me. And, you know, I definitely needed a psychic change. Just by the grace of God, someone 12-stepped me into this program back in 1994. I came in through a different program. And so what I found out, of course, was, you know, it's pretty impossible to get any kind of recovery in another program whenever your God or your idol is food. And so in early 1995, I finally landed in OA, which is, you know, where I really belong. And so what follows next, I got to tell you, is all God and hardly any of me, because, you know, God can take a life that is in complete and total shambles and, you know, turn it around and make it, you know, something. I have to say, it's beyond my wildest dreams. So you take me on death's door, and that's how I arrived here in 1995. You know, I got in, and I will say that I worked the steps. I did have a sponsor. I was shown what to do. I will say I didn't do it perfectly. And boy, oh boy, I was still mad. I was still angry that God had, you know, put me between a rock and a hard place. I say God did. I did. I put myself between a rock and a hard place, and God rescued me from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So I was still angry. And I did work the program in a very limited way. I did exactly what my sponsor told me. I was a newbie. I had limited knowledge and experience. I will say I didn't know what I didn't know. Nevertheless, God met me there, and He is willing to meet me anywhere as long as I'm willing to surrender to put my own will down, not perfectly, but that I am trying to head in that direction. God will meet me wherever I'm at and move me forward. And I have to say, He did absolute miracles in my life. You know, I was pondering this morning. I was thinking about our meeting. I don't know where you could go in the general population where you could find a conglomerate of this many miracles. I mean, there are how many of us ever there are in line this morning? All of us are walking, talking miracles. It kind of blows my mind. It just amazes me. Anyway, God just did some absolute miracles in my life. He restored me to a normal body weight, and I have to tell you, God has maintained that normal body weight now within about 10 pounds for 30 years. For 30 years, I've worn the same clothes. I've worn the same size clothes, and to me, that is just an absolute miracle. He restored my health. I got off all my meds, all my blood pressure medication. I became physically active from a person who, you know, could barely get up out of her chair to somebody who, was active. And the other thing that He did was He restored my relationship with my children. These kids went from, you know, being physically, verbally, and emotionally abused by me to actually seeking out my company and wanting to be with me. Other things happened. I ended up getting my undergraduate degree. I started a career. I later went on to get my graduate degree and change careers. I don't even know how that happens. But when God is involved, things continue to get better and better and better. When I'm involved and it's my will, things get worse and worse and worse. So I had about 10 years of back-to-back abstinence in the program. And I will say that, you know, things are really good. I'll talk a little bit about my relapses. So a friend of mine says, a really great quote, "Don't let the gifts of the program rob you of the gifts of the program." And there's an AA speaker that I listen to, and I love him. He says, "People who lose touch with their step one experience are doomed to repeat it." Well, those are, you know, harbingers of things that happened in my life. I had such an active life, and things were going well for me, and I did let the gifts of the program rob me of my sanity, my serenity, my spiritual connection. And, you know, it's really hard sometimes when things are going well to remember how powerless I used to be and how close to death's door I was. And so what I did was I just gradually forgot that I have a fatal progressive illness, and my disease is progressive in nature, and it's always looking for a sneaky way to get back in. And what it had done is it just progressed to the point where it outsmarted me. My disease at that stage of the game was never going to, you know, present me with a cake, you know, because I saw that coming. But what it did was it went around behind me through the back door and just outsmarted me that way. My disease is cunning, baffling, and powerful. It's very, very deceptive, and it's looking for an opening somewhere else. And so here's the thing. I feel like By the way, my first relapse lasted about 13 years. It was god-awful. And I did not go back to how bad things were before, but it was pretty awful. And I'm going to tell you what I learned from my first relapse. What I learned from my first relapse is I don't think I had a good handle on the phenomenon of craving that's talked about in the doctor's opinion, on the allergy of the body. And coupled with that, my ego, my pride got involved, and I had been doing a bunch of really intense spiritual work. And the two of those together sold me an idea. One of our fellows says that our disease is like a salesperson, you know, and it's constantly trying to sell us something. And my disease sold me the crazy idea that because I was in such good spiritual condition, I could probably moderately eat some of my binge foods. And I honestly, I don't even think it started out with my binge foods. I think it probably just started out with some stuff that wasn't really on my food plan. Nevertheless, however that happened, I believed the lie again because I had no defense against that first drink. I had let go of my spiritual connection. I had let go of the program. I had let go of my step one experience. And my disease found a way in. And so 13 years later, just to sum that up, because you all know the disease is terrible. I woke up one morning with that old familiar feeling of, okay, what am I going to do today to try to get this thing under control? And the short answer is I'm not going to do anything because I am powerless over the food. As soon as my mind starts to put into place the next scheme or how I'm going to have to tighten up my food or, you know, how I'm going to have to get rid of this or, you know, stop eating that except when I go out to restaurants or, you know, whatever, all of that stuff is my own power. And I forget, I'm completely and totally beyond human aid. I'm without defense against that first bite. And if I am thinking like that, that's a sure sign to me in my own experience, the disease is here and it's running the show again because I'm not going to do anything. God is going to have to do it. And one morning, I woke up with that familiar tune playing over in my head. What am I going to do to get control of this? And as clear as a bell, I felt God's voice in my spirit. I don't hear the audible voice of God, but I felt his voice in my spirit. It was before I was even awake in the morning. And he said, just as clear as day, if you don't get back to AA, you're going to die. You're going to die. And so I thought to myself, what am I going to do? I don't really have any confidence in the way I've been working the steps and the tools of the program and all of the stuff I was doing. Well, fortunately for me, somebody plugged me into vision meetings. And wow, all I've got to say is when I plugged in, I thought to myself, you know what? There's something different here. These people are on fire. And you know that big book that I had read a few times and loved, by the way, it came to life. And I began to see, oh, hey, okay, here's the original recipe for how these people got recovered. So I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. And, you know, things went well for a time, but I failed to enlarge my spiritual life. And also, my ego started to creep back in again, and I started to think to myself, you know what? I love this meeting, but these people, I think they're a bunch of fanatics. And you know what? I know I'm sick, but I don't know that I'm quite that sick and that I really need to do all of the stuff that they're doing. So I kind of drifted away again And so, real quick, let me tell you what I learned from my second relapse. From my second relapse, I learned that I am just as sick as you. And I learned that I do have to submit to some discipline. And I do have to submit to sponsorship. I can't just do it my way. That's a repeat of what how things used to be for me. And so I had to come back in, and I needed to get a sponsor, and I needed to work the steps, and I did. And I have to say that the thing that's changed for me this time around, the thing that's changed for me is I no longer see that 12th step as a suggestion. I no longer see sponsorship as optional. Fortunately for me, I got a sponsor who pushed, working with others. And I have to say that has been a real game changer for me. I will celebrate my second abstinence anniversary in less than a month. And on the first night that my sponsor and I talked back in 2024, she said, you know what, this could be your last relapse. You don't ever have to do this again. This could be the start of an abstinence that lasts until you breathe your last breath. And I believe in the power of the steps, and I believe in the power of my God to take care of me. So what I want to say about sponsorship, we've heard this quoted a lot of times in meetings, and it's on 14 and 15, page 14 and 15 in the big book. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. And what I want to say about that, it says in a couple of lines before that our faith in God without works is dead. And what that tells me is I have to get out of myself. I have to be giving this program away. I choose to do that through sponsorship. And so I am generally not without a sponsee. I am usually talking to more than one of my sponsees. And I will say that, this sponsorship has given me a whole lot of bang for my buck. It helps me to get out of myself. And also, I get to maintain connection with my step one experience, because most of the people that I'm working with are either coming out of relapse, or they're a newcomer to the program. And so I get to live vicariously through them my step one experience over and over and over again. And I get to work through these steps every single time that I go through the steps with them. So here's what I want to do for the remainder of my time. I want to talk to you a little bit about a couple of areas that God has done some really, really good, deep work with me in. The areas would be in the areas of my children and the restoration of my relationship with them, and also in the area of my fear and anxiety disorder. So what I'll say about my sons, I had some really, really good sponsorship early on in the program. And I had a sponsor when I first got in who told me that I'd called her one more time about some big emotional blow-up that I'd just had with my kids. And she said to me one time after we'd been working together, it's probably a few months, she said, you know what? If you're going to continue to blow up at your kids and abuse them and hit them, that's your choice and there's nothing I can do about it. But I am not going to stay around and watch you do that, because what you're doing to yourself is soul-sucking, and what you're doing to your kids is going to put you back into your disease. And so I'm either going to sponsor you, and we're going to come up with a way for you to get yourself under control, or else you're going to need to find another sponsor. And so she and I worked together on a plan of action, and I had some good outside help as well to help me with the whole situation. Those two things coupled together were enough to restore me to sanity in my relationship with my children. I, at first, had to go put myself in timeout. My kids laughed because I would tell them, hey, I'm feeling a little upset right now, and I'm going to go put myself in timeout, and I'll be back in 5 minutes. And I would go back to my bedroom and lock the door so that I had some quiet time to pray, and I would ask God to help me, and he did. And that, coupled with the good outside help that I got, was enough to restore my relationship with my kids. These kids went from cowering when I was angry to wanting to spend time with me, to wanting to just do simple little things with me, like go to the grocery store. They would have the option of staying home when they were older, but they would just say, hey, Mom, I want to go, you know. And so we'd just wander through the grocery store and talk and laugh and, you know, yeah, I mean, it's wonderful. And those kids today, one of them is 40, the other is 36. They both call me just to talk, just to visit. In fact, my older son calls me once or twice a week. We call it a ramble. And it means that for the next 10 minutes while we're driving home from work, one of us gets to ramble about whatever topic we want to ramble about. And I maintain a very, very close relationship with him today. The other one lives out of state, still calls me, still comes to see me. I love them both dearly. They've given me 4 grandchildren between the two of them, and I am so grateful today. I am not the angry, insane person that I was in this disease. So again, that has just been a real godsend. The other thing I want to talk a little bit about is my anxiety. So if you remember from earlier on in my story, horrible anxiety disorder, lots of panic attacks, agoraphobia, that kind of stuff. And I will say that the program did wonders. The program probably did more for my anxiety than all of the outside help that I've gotten. And I've gotten some really great outside help. In my recovery, my anxiety has been relatively low. However, it's probably been 8 or 9 years ago, God brought to my attention that I was still avoiding new experiences, things that pushed me outside of my comfort zone, because I didn't want to be uncomfortable, and I didn't want to feel anxious. And it was easier for me just to do my normal rut of a life, which was good, by the way, but wasn't what I felt I was being called to. So I noticed that avoiding. And, here's the thing. Avoidance, while it helped me not to feel uncomfortable, it's not freedom. It's not living in where I knew God wanted me to be. And so, really, for all intents and purposes, I was still worshiping at the idol of comfort. And worshiping at the idol of fear, basically, and trying to appease it by never doing anything that might cause me to feel fearful. And so what happened to me in 2017, and it's been a long journey, and I don't have time to go into any of the details here, but suffice it to say that God started to call me out on these crazy adventures. The first one was this cross-country in 2017, this cross-country trip chasing an eclipse, and that was completely and totally unplanned and totally outside of my comfort zone. I was terrified. The whole 3 days I was gone. It was totally out of character. When my best friend found out what I was doing, she was like, "Do I need to call somebody for you? Because this just doesn't sound like you. Are you sure you're okay?" And I wondered myself if I was okay, but nevertheless, God persisted. This gave way to several more adventures that took me way outside my comfort zone. One of the most notorious ones was a rafting trip through the Grand Canyon in 2020. And God called me to go on that trip, and no one else I knew was insane enough to do anything like that. I did go with an outfitter. I'm not gonna paddle. I'm 68 years old, so I wasn't physically up for that. So I did go with an outfitter, but it was 8 days, way outside my comfort zone, and all was going well. And then on day four, we had a really freak accident. Everybody else on the boat was just fine. I got a crush injury to my right lower leg that required a life flight out of the canyon and a surgery, 15 screws and a couple of steel plates and 5 months of PT to my right lower leg. And on the day I got out of the hospital after that surgery, the rafting company called to check on me, number one, and to ask me if I ever wanted to go on another trip like that, because the seats for next year were filling up fast. And I heard God again, just as plain as day in my spirit, say yes. And so the next year, almost to the day, I went back and did that whole trip again from start to finish. This time, the last 4 days, of course, were, totally new, because I hadn't seen that part of the canyon. And let me just tell you what I learned about myself on that trip. And short story is, the adventures have continued since then. And here's what I have found out. What I found out is that, God doesn't always remove my fear. On page 68 of our big book, it talks about how to deal with fear. And first we inventory it, and it gives us directions to inventory our fear. And then it gives us what we call the fear prayer. It says we ask him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what he would have us see. And then it gives us a promise. It says, at once we commence to outgrow fear. And so here's what I want to say about God and me and my fear and anxiety and getting outside of my comfort zone. I want to say that, he's not necessarily removed my fear all the time. Sometimes he just helps me to outgrow it. I feel like I've grown so much since 2017 that it no longer bothers me that I'm afraid. Yes, I'm afraid. I'm doing something that's outside of my comfort zone. And, it's kind of normal to feel afraid when you're doing something that you're unfamiliar with. And so I have basically just accepted that fear for me and anxiety when doing new things is just a part of my life, and it's part of the bargain, and it's part of the way that God helps me to understand reality. And the reality is, God rules my life. Fear doesn't run my life anymore. And so when I have it, it's okay. And I will say that I don't have it during my normal day-to-day life. About the only time that I feel afraid or anxious anymore is when I'm doing something new, some crazy adventure that God's called me on. My adventures have gone from, learning how to kayak to spending the night in the woods all by myself, I'm a novice backpacker, just some, you know, some different things there. And again, when I'm doing those things, which are new and uncomfortable, it's normal for me to be anxious. And so I just recently got back from one of those adventures, and I was having a, you know, kind of having a little pity party for myself during the adventure. And I was telling God that I'm cold and I'm tired and my back hurts. And I was whining about how difficult this trip was. And once again, in my spirit, I heard him say to me, "Yeah, Renee, I know it's hard, but you know what else is hard? Dying slowly in your recliner, in your comfort zone, without ever having lived, without ever having gone out here and experienced this. I can do hard things today. I can do things afraid today. And for that, I am very, very grateful." This program has not only saved my life, it's given me a life. When I got in here, I thought food was the problem. Food is not the problem. I'm the problem, and God is my solution. And so, again, I'm just going to close by saying how very, very grateful I am for you all that are on the line every day, for those of you that do service, you know, for those of you that just show up for these big book, for this big book, you know, for these steps that showed me how to find God, for these steps that cleared away the blockage so that God's incredible love and delivering power could save me. And so, yeah, I'm going to close by saying that I'm a grateful compulsive overeater. I used to get so mad when I'd hear people say that. But today I am extremely grateful to be in your presence. And with that, I'm going to pass.
Thanks, Renee. So appreciative. Thanks for such an authentic, lovely, practical share this morning. We're so appreciative of you this morning. And a couple of things. Please hang out till the end of the recorded portion, at which time we will ask Renee A for her contact information. I'm going to just spell Renee. I think for people know how to spell it, but I have R-E-N-E-E. And that's Renee A. in Oklahoma. So let me also give you the share ID. Yeah, thanks, Renee. Let me give you the share ID for her presentation this morning. That number is 23,287. That's 23287. And again, we'll see her. We'll ask her for contact information at the end of the recorded hour. With that said, let's move on to our time for questions for Renee. If you have a question for Renee, you're going to unmute by pressing *1 and give me your first name. Who has a question for Renee?
Shelly.
Can I get that? Stephanie. Is that Rifka? Stephanie?
Did you get Rifka?
Yeah.
I did. Yeah, I got. So far, I have Stephanie and Rifka. Who else?
Maggie A.
Hi, Maggie. Gotcha.
Pete B.
Polly B.
Hey, Pete. And was that Paula?
Polly.
Oh, Polly. Okay. Polly, I gotcha. Stephanie, Rifka, Maggie, Pete, Polly. Anybody else?
Alia A.
Say that again. Okay, let me tell you who I heard. I heard Stephanie, Rivka, Maggie, Pete, Polly, and was it Anya? Or am I making that up? I make things up.
Ania A.
Ania. Ania. Okay.
No, Ania. A-N-Y-A. Ania.
Okay, was that A-M-E-Y? Ania?
No.
Like that?
A-L. Y-A.
Anya. Okay.
Alia.
Gotcha. Anya. Okay, Anya, gotcha. So let's see. Anybody else? Questions for Renee this morning?
Dina S., New York.
Boy, am I having trouble. Was that Tina?
Dina with a D.
Dina. Thanks, Dina. Okay, let's go with that first round. We'll see where we're at, time and all that stuff. Stephanie, Rivka, Maggie, Pete, Pauly, Ania, and Dina. Okay, let's start with Stephanie. Good morning, Stephanie. What question do you have for Renee?
Hi, good morning. This is Stephanie P. from Clifton, New Jersey. Thank you so much, Renee. I just started with a sponsor, and she keeps mentioning to me about self-sacrifice, like make sure you do for others. And I get the self-sacrifice part about sponsorship and doing service in that way. But early in recovery, what are some examples that you maybe could suggest for what that would mean? Because I don't know. I feel like I need like a checklist of things of like options.
I like that question a lot because you're right. I mean, until we've worked through these steps, we're not in a place to be able to sponsor. But yeah, we can definitely do service. So I'll just tell you some of the ways that I've found to do service, you know, while I was working through the steps but wasn't quite recovered yet. First of all, you know, every meeting or most meetings have a place where newcomers can introduce themselves. And what I have done in the past is during that time, I've had a pencil and paper or my phone ready and taken down names and numbers of the newcomers to the meeting. You know, in A Vision for You, we do that between our meetings. Lots of times I've taken those numbers down and just texted or called those people for an outreach call. Because here's the thing, if someone is new and let's say I've got, you know, 30 days of abstinence and I'm working through the steps, you know, I have a bit of something to share about my own experience. And the other thing is I might just be able to call them and ask them how they're doing, how's the program going and so forth. And so that's one way. Another thing that I did even before I met the abstinence requirements was I would volunteer at meetings to read the steps or the tradition. Usually there's not an abstinence requirement to do those little bits of service. And, you know, that's something that's definitely needed. Another way that I have, you know, found to be of service is to lead meetings. You know, if I meet the abstinence requirements, or I wouldn't say lead, but like chair meetings. And also just showing up. And if I'm on a Zoom, turning my camera on so that people can see my face, and just sharing my experience, strength, and hope at a meeting. Again, there's usually no abstinence requirement for that. And so, yeah, those are definitely some of the things that I've done. And also, not just to newcomers or compulsive overeaters, but in my daily life, there are people that I run across all the time that could use a kind word, something that, you know, I may be able to do something for them, a small favor or something like that. And so all of those things just help me to get out of me.
Thanks, Stephanie. Okay, Rivka, it's your turn with a question followed by Maggie. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks so much, Larry. And oh my, Renee, you are so inspiring. My heart's still thumping hearing about all that you went through, you know, outgrowing fear. And my question is, I don't think I could ever do anything like that. And I remember hearing your first, you know, special edition around all these things that you, you know, did with God's help. But it leaves me with the feeling of, if I can't ever do something like that, does that mean that I'm inadequate and I'm not doing a good program? I guess that's my question. Like, I don't even know how to form this, but like, it's just the thought of it is so terrifying that I wouldn't even go there. Like, and I hope whatever God never takes me there. But that's my question. Like, if you feel like no, that's too much. That's I can't do that. There's a lack in my own program.
Hey, Rivka, I'm really glad you asked that, because here's the thing. You know what? This is my story. This is what God's called me to. Okay. But here's what I would say to you and anybody else that's listening. Oh my gosh, no. You know, that is so not a prescription for outgrowing fear. You know, you guys out there may be facing all different kinds of things that are pushing you outside of your comfort zone. I think for me, what I found was that God just wanted me to get outside of my comfort zone. So for you, well, that might look like, I don't know, like just going out of the house today and taking a walk. It might look like, you know, calling somebody from this line and reaching out to them. You know, that may be enough of a fear, you know, that that's outside of your comfort zone. So, you know, again, this is not a prescription for everybody. This is my own tailor-made prescription from God. But for others out there, especially, you know, people who really struggle a lot with fear and anxiety, you know, it could be just doing one tiny little thing today that
Thank
makes
you
uncomfortable. Yeah, and so the thing too, I would clarify and say, you know, a lot of times when I pray the fear prayer and ask God, after I've inventoried, when I pray the fear prayer and ask God to remove my fear, He removes it. It doesn't always stay put with me, but I guess what I want to be heard from my God story is that it no longer controls me, as in I have outgrown fear, in that I have outgrown the need for it to be completely removed before I go do this thing. So please just ask God today, what small, tiny little thing does He want you to do that might make you uncomfortable? That's where everyone needs to start, is what God tells us about what He wants from us today. And so with that, I'll close.
Thanks for the question, Rivka. Okay, Maggie, it's your turn, followed by Pete. Good morning, Maggie.
Good morning.
Maggie, press start. Oh, there you are.
Yep. Thanks. I'm so grateful for your service, Larry and Renee. Thank you. My question is, when you were talking at the very beginning about, you know, overeating, and then you said, or a pathological, I think you said something about a pathological eater. So I wonder, and the reason I'm asking specifically is I know that I'm an abnormal eater. I have an abnormal relationship with food. And I'm still early. I haven't done all the steps yet. I do have a sponsor. But I never overeat, or very, very rarely. And I know there's all different types of problem eaters and, you know, eating disorders, I guess what I'm trying to say. So I'm just a pure sugar addict, is I think more of the best label for me, but not that to get too involved in labels. But I wonder if you could just clarify a little bit more when you said pathological eater. Yeah, that's my question. Thanks.
Well, okay. So thanks for the question. And it's so funny because I remember saying that and thinking that my brain was searching for an adjective to describe our disordered eating. And so I wouldn't place any particular weight on the word pathological. It was my brain searching for an adjective for our insane eating and eating behaviors. The foods, you know, the eating or the lack of eating, the ingredients, foods or behaviors, all of that to me, you know, falls under the heading of compulsive eating. And so, yeah, I didn't really mean much of anything specific using the word pathological, but I think it's fairly obvious that our behavior with food is not normal. Whatever your behavior with food, you know, it probably ranges somewhere outside of normal behavior with food, and that's probably why you're listening to this meeting. So, yeah, with that, I'll pass.
Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Maggie. All right, we have Pete next, followed by Paulie. Pete, good morning.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for taking the meeting and doing a great job. And Renee, thanks. That was great. I really liked hearing about the adventures and pushing, you know, the boundaries of our comfort zone. So I just thought my question to you was this. It says, and there was a solution that says our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent, and practically means almost. Could you talk about why it says practically versus entirely non-existent? Because it sounds like you're using your willpower and it seems to be working pretty well for you in some areas of your life.
Oh, I will do it. Just give me one moment, okay?
Thanks, Pete. Well, okay. So I'm not exactly sure what you're referring to.
I'm referring to page 24, and there is a solution in italics. It says our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent.
And I am turning right there. Yeah, and I would say that as far as food is concerned, I feel like I relate to this a lot. I have lost the power of choice with my food eating and food behaviors. And I think that I think maybe one of the reasons that he uses the word practically non-existent, you know, I have at times been able in my relapses and in my, you know, that those 36 years that I spent in the food, I have at certain times been able to postpone my eating or, you know, whatever. But the thing is, for all intents and purposes, I would say that my willpower was actually non-existent because, again, there were times I was able to postpone a binge, but never completely and totally forego a binge. And so eventually it always caught back up with me. And I, you know, I remain, you know, without defense against that first drink even today, despite the fact that I'm recovered, I work the steps, you know, I'm abstinent. I feel like that once again, for me, it is non-existent, my so-called willpower. I'll pass with that.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Pete, for the question. And next up, we have Paulie, followed by Aaliyah. Paulie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for your service. Thanks to everyone who makes this meeting possible, and Renee. That was really a great talk. I'm grateful you devoted so much.
I think we may, if my phone's correct, I think we may have lost Paulie here. Paulie, can you press star one again?
You're right. I was. Anyway, I'll jump over. Yeah. I was riveted by your journeys into your discomfort zones, and they sounded, some of them, quite exhilarating. My question is, if and how do you monitor the right size of those discomfort zone expeditions, whether or not there are any kind of compulsive aspects to it? I ask because part of my recovery has been from compulsive physical thrill-seeking behaviors in addition to compulsive eating. And I was relieved of the activity aspects, extreme stuff through injury before program. And I can tell by my reaction to your sharing that my brain is still very much interested in those kinds of things. So I'd appreciate any thoughts or response you have. Thank you.
Thanks, Polly. I appreciate that. Well, I think that it sounds to me like our both of our recoveries have been about God moving us more towards the middle, you know, towards sanity. So I'm an extreme, you know, non-risk taker, and you know, actually, you know, God had been pushing on me for several years for me to live my life, and I felt like I had, you know, turned a lot of my will and my life over to him, but he highlighted, you know, this area where things are not submitted to him. And so what I would say is it all has to do with surrender and submission to God's will for me. So I don't do things today unless I feel a leading from my higher power to do them. And even then, I pray through things and I rely completely on him to make decisions for me about what to do, what activities to do, and that kind of thing. And so I think, you know, I think it goes back to, you know, what do I feel is, you know, what do I feel called by God to do? What's he asking of me today? And, you know, a lot of times it doesn't have anything to do with some adventure. It, you know, it may have to do with a particular client at work, or it may have to do with something mundane like a job assignment, or, you know, developing some new material at work or something like that. And so, you know, it doesn't always manifest itself in something big. It's in the small details. But again, you know, my time belongs to God. My life belongs to God. And so he gets to say what I do with my time and when. So I'll leave it with that.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Polly. Okay, Aaliyah, it's your turn, followed by Dina. Good morning to you, Aaliyah.
Good morning. So thank you, Larry, for your service. And wow, Renee, thank you for sharing your story and your transformation. Amazing. So my question was, when you were talking about your children, you said two things, that you did an action plan with your sponsor and you got some outside help. So just wanted, you know, to get more, like, what are the key things that helped you the most in these two things, you know, that caused you that transformation as a mother? Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Aaliyah. Well, yeah. And so here's what I want to say about that. I really don't want to go into too many specifics about that plan or any of my outside help, because I really feel like that varies from person to person. And again, it has everything to do with God and very little to do with me. I will say that all of the recovery that I have in this area, you know, started by doing a very thorough inventory on my selfishness, my dishonesty, self-seeking, resentment, fear, all of that kind of stuff, and talking to God about what my part is, following through with a fifth step, with a sixth and seventh, and then, you know, making amends to my kids. But a verbal amends, obviously, you know, wouldn't fit the bill, and so there was a living amends that had to happen as well. Again, I, you know, back then, all of the things that I did were part of working the steps and working with a sponsor
Don't, and again, don't want to be too specific about it because it would vary from person to person. I think a good first step for me was to do a really, really good inventory. And then to work out with a sponsor how I'm going to respond when these situations come up. I probably need to pass there and not get down into the specifics. You can always call me afterwards if you want to talk some more.
Thank you. Thanks, Aaliyah. Okay, next up we have Dina, and then we'll see where we're at after that, perhaps some more time. Good morning, Dina.
Good morning, and thank you so much for your presentation this morning. I identified with a lot of it. It's like the words were coming right out of my mouth. The only thing that I really don't identify with is the activity levels. I wanted to ask you, were you active before the disease? And if not, or even if so, how did you get back into it? Did you ask higher power for help? And that's it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for that question. I was active as a child, and I think that that's probably why I was not an overweight child. I was relatively active. But when I began to, when I got back into, my eating disorder has been with me ever since birth. And so I think that, you know, in my 20s, when I began to eat with a vengeance, when I began to binge eat, I ceased all activity. I literally broke the frame of my recliner because I sat in it so much. And when I began to recover through the 12 steps and through working this program, my life started to get better. One of the pluses was my body weight began to decrease. And I began to approach a normal body weight. Again, exercise and activity is an outside issue because some of us even struggle with that. And so what I will say again is that I felt that God was asking me to become more active. And so our third step is about us turning our life and our will over to the care of God. And I began to do what I feel like he was asking me to do. And gradually, as my body weight came down and my activity level came up, I was able to be restored to a somewhat normal activity level. And what I do today at 68, I'm definitely not some kind of an extreme athlete. I actually am coping with several injuries and, limiting factors. I think the biggest thing is, through 10, 11, and 12, I pray in the mornings and throughout the day, and I attempt to do what I feel like God is calling me to do, and I feel that's probably restored me to a more normal activity level. So I really, again, probably don't need to get down into the specifics of that. But if you want to talk afterwards, feel free to reach out.
Thanks, Dina. Well, we have time if there's perhaps a couple more questions, maybe two or three more questions. Hi, Tony. Who else?
Bev M.
Was it Bev?
Robin P. Yes.
Okay. Let's go with that. Let's stop with Robin, and then we'll see where we're at. So we have Tony, Bev, and Robin. Hey, Tony. Good morning to you.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for your service. Thank you so much for this presentation. It's been wonderful. It sounds like you have a close relationship with God, of your understanding. How do you understand God, and what do you know of him, or she, or it?
Wow, that's a deep question.
I would love to hear your experiences.
Well, okay. So I guess I would say, to kind of sum things up, I grew up in a very a-religious, a-spiritual home. Like, there, you know, we did not have a relationship with God in my home, and I basically had none with him. And so things progressed, and I ran my life on my own self-will, and, you know, with the predicted results. So I do feel like I prayed a lot of foxhole prayers, you know, God, please take this away from me. Those prayers were later answered in the form of these 12 steps. However, I arrived at this program very, very opposed to the God idea. I was so angry about that second step. I just can't even tell you. It's one of the reasons I spent my first 18 months in this program just angry, because I did not want to have to submit my life and my will to the care of something bigger than me. I wanted to be in charge, even though it had brought me to the brink of death. And so what I'll say is that there's a phrase in our book that says, open-minded as the dying can be. I was dying, and I had to be open-minded. And so I got in, and God began to show me, he began to show me the quality, who he was, the nature of who he is. And I would pray prayers a lot of times. God, I want to resign from the debating society. I don't want to have some kind of preconceived notion about who you are. Show me who you are. Show me. And he began to show me who he is, his power, his love for me. And I began to let that play out in my life. And I must say, in 30 years, my understanding of who God is has changed and changed and changed again. God hasn't changed, but I've changed in my understanding of him. I've grown over that time in my experience with him, and I've been able to experience him in all different facets, not in all, because he's, you know, infinitely more complex. But experience some of the facets of who he is. And I am so grateful for that, because that is what saved me. It's not my own doing, but it's finding God through these 12 steps that saved me, that's given me a life. And I'm very grateful. I don't understand him completely. He's beyond my understanding. If I could understand him completely, I couldn't worship him. And I do worship him. And I credit him with everything that's good in my life. And with that, I'll pass.
Thanks, Tony. Okay, Bev, it's your turn, followed by Robin. Good morning, Bev.
Thanks, Larry, for your service. And Renee, thank you so much for your share. I'm wondering if you could share how you use the 10th step in your journey to work through that fear and anxiety.
That's great. I love that question. And the 10th step is super important to me. So, you know, our 10th step tells us that as we go throughout the day, we're continuing to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And so, you know, I think that what's necessary there, first of all, is an awareness of God and his presence in my life. you know, it also talks to us a little bit about, you know, as we go through our day in step 11, and it talks about whenever we're agitated or doubtful. So when I feel that fear cropping up in me, and it could be any number of things, you know, doubt, insecurity, second guessing myself, anything like that. You know, I'm told the directions in the book tell me that I immediately need to take that to God. And so what I do in my 10th step every day is I take that to God. I take a quick inventory of where I've been selfish in my fear, where I'm dishonest, where I'm resentful. And I I will definitely reach out to someone when I need to discuss that. Usually my fear doesn't require any kind of an amends. But, you know, the Big Book talks to us a little bit about why we have that fear. And it's because we're self-reliant. If I wasn't relying on myself and my own finite power, I wouldn't have the fear. And so I use the 10th step to uncover that. I can take that to God. I can confess it and talk to him about it and talk to another fellow. I can ask him to remove it and then show me who he would have me be. And usually I will say that my fear is removed. When it's not removed, I can ask him to help me to continue on in whatever I feel that he's asked me to do. despite the fact that I have that fear, and I can also, you know, ask him to help me to rely on him. Sometimes I'm not able to muster that on my own, the reliance on him, but I can ask him and he'll give it to me freely. I use that 10th step several times a day when I feel fear crop up, and it's been extremely useful and helpful in connecting me with God and getting me out of myself.
Thanks, Beth. All right, our last question, our Broadway girl. Hey, Robin, did you know they told me early on I have a face for radio? So good morning to you.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you so much for your service. Renee, God bless you. I just loved your share. It was so timed amazingly for me personally, and just I love your surrender. Just so touching, so inspiring. Thank you so much. I'm sending you such a big hug. I'm going for my dreams right now in a whole new big way, and I just loved your share. I was going to ask you about the 10th step. That just got asked, but when you're in the middle of one of your adventures and the fear comes up, can you talk about that process? And thank you again. God bless you.
Yeah, thanks, Robin, for that question. Well, I think, you know, it goes back to, you know, to that 10th and 11th and 12th. And, you know, that's one of the things that's different for me today is, you know, to the best of my ability, I strive to practice that 10, 11, and 12. And so I like that part in the 11th step that talks about when I'm agitated or doubtful. And so when I'm on something like, you know, something that I feel like God's called me to, whatever the adventure is, like I said, it could be something in the office that day. And I find myself resisting, you know, the first thing that I will do is pause. Practicing the pause has been a really, really great, you know, thing for me, following those directions, practicing that pause. So I stop what I'm doing and I just say, hey, God, I'm feeling really afraid right now. You know, help me to sort out what's going on with me. And I will do a quick inventory. When I'm out, sometimes I'm not able
to, you know, call or text another person, but I can, you know, stop in that moment and ask God to help me sort things out. Usually, always, it's because I'm in self-reliance. I think I have to do this thing. And when I can lean back away from that self-reliance and let God move in, I find that, maybe not in the moment, but in that time, that he allows me to access his strength and, you know, his solidity, and that I'm able to go ahead and do what I feel like he's called me to do. And so I found that for me, it's using that 10th step, asking him to help me back out of self-reliance, and then asking him what he would have me do, that's step 11, and then asking him for the strength to do that. And so, yeah, that's definitely been the key for me in the moment when I'm feeling fearful. I'll pass with that.
Thanks, Robin, and thanks to everyone for the questions. And if you just on the line this morning, we're glad you're here. And a special, special thanks to Renee A. from Oklahoma. Renee, just another great contribution to the archives, and thank you so much, Renee. So please stick around as we will end the recorded portion in just a moment, and we'll ask Renee for our contact information. And we're now going to close with a reading from the big book on page 164. And it goes a little bit like this. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Well, I know we're trying to